Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
From Harrah's Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harrah.
You're good, kid. But as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up.
Now, from the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
Coming up on the show today, breaking news about Full Tilt Poker and the deal. Also, Faraz Jaka, the poker pro who played a couple weeks ago in the iSeries Live event in Ireland, and the director of the all-in poker movie documentary, Doug Tirola, on a very busy Final Table show today. Hello, I am Paul Harrah, sitting in the poker room of the Harrah's St. Louis World Series of Poker Room, where things are calming down. The tournament tables have all been put away after 12 straight days of circuit activity. My partner Dennis Phillips was here for much of it, but is now back home in Las Vegas. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
I'm doing well. Spent the last week in St. Louis. Ran into a lot of people that I used to sit at the tables with. It was kind of cool. I enjoyed it.
How were your results?
I played in four tournaments, and I ran deep in one. The 565 one. I finished final table, and I finished seventh in that tournament. The others, the main event, I got down to somewhere around 100th place out of the monster field we had. We had, 630 in it.
Yep.
So I was close to the money, but about 40 from the money when I got knocked out.
Yeah, I played in the main event also, made it to day two, but only lasted through another 3.5 levels on day two, and so I didn't cash. I did manage to cash in two of the first three tournaments, which we talked about on last week's show. So with that and cash turned it into a, you know, fairly successful 12 days for me and a very successful 12 days for Harrah's St. Louis and the World Series of Poker circuit folks. Denise Nikowski, the poker room manager, and her crew, and Bill Bruce and his crew from Poker Tournament Consultants, who ran the whole thing, did a great job. The fields were up by more than 20% over last year. The main event this weekend, which was the re-entry event for the first time, up 39% over last year's field. We had the largest poker tournament in Missouri history the first weekend in that 1,066-person re-entry event. We had two guys who racked up their fourth gold rings. Kyle Cartwright, a 24-year-old pro from Tulsa who won the 1K event here. That's his fourth career WSOP circuit title. He won the main event here last year, so this has been a good venue for him. And Kurt Jewell won event number 12, which finished up here last night, to pick up his fourth gold ring victory. And congratulations to Trip Kirk, who rooms with Kyle on the road. These two guys are monsters, as is their friend AP Farhat. The three of them travel together, and Trip Kirk took down the main event here. They finished up yesterday. Cartwright took down the 1K, and AP finished up second in that one. So those three guys pretty much dominated the big buy-in events here. That means that Trip Kirk goes to the national championship, as does another qualifier named of Nick Stone. And I also want to give a special tribute here to a friend of mine by the name of Tim Kilday, who I've known for many years in the 5-10 games here in St. Louis. He's from Columbia, big fan of the University of Missouri, always wears his Mizzou gear when he's playing poker, and was wearing it yesterday as he made it to day three and then made it down to the final table and then made it to heads up with Trip Kirk. He was a 3-1 dog and never could overcome that, and the final heads-up battle only lasted a few hands before Tripp actually took the thing down. But congratulations to Tim on his $118,000 second-place finish, and to Tripp on his $191,000 first-place finish this weekend. Always good to see guys who are not pros necessarily, but just recreational players making deep runs in events like this.
I absolutely agree, and it seemed like every final table there had somebody from around this area sitting at it. It was pretty awesome.
Yep.
You get down to the final two or three tables, I could walk over to any one of those and find people I used to play with. So I love that aspect of it. So
yep.
if you didn't make it to this one, you got to be back here next year.
Yep.
600 and some in the main event, 200,000 for first prize, and a guy that we sit there and play with day after day comes in second.
Yep. Pretty cool.
There you go.
The cash games were going crazy, flowing out of the room into the tournament area every night. Right before going on the air, one of the guys who plays in the 1-2 cash games here came up to me and said, "Would you please thank all the out-of-towners for coming into town and contributing to the Bad Beat jackpot without winning it?" You know, all those extra dollars being dropped for the last 12 days have pushed the jackpot up to $81K in the room. We did have one boondoggle during this. That is not the fault of the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, but the regulations that are in place for Missouri. And that had to do with the $75 super satellite on Friday for people trying to get in to the main event. The line was going very, very slowly because the way it's set up, you can't do your rebuys and add-ons at the table. In Missouri, you're not allowed to ever give cash to a dealer and get chips or rebuys or add-ons, so you had to do it all at the window when you first bought into the event. And to do that, they had to process each one as a separate transaction. They had to swipe your card and do your buy-in. They had to swipe your card again and do your rebuy. Had to swipe it again to do your add-on. Swipe it again to do a second add-on. And that took time. It took, you know, maybe 90 seconds to 2 minutes per player. And when you've got an event that is drawing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of players and over 1,000 rebuys and add-ons, it can take a long time to get everybody in. I was in the line, didn't think I'd have to get here that early, but when I did, I was very disappointed and ended up standing in that line for 3 hours, finally got in after the break, after level four. Very, very frustrating situation, which I know Harrah's is going to work on fixing for next year. But I do want to say one thing, Dennis, and I know you can relate to this because you remember the debacle at the main event a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Poker players, and I include myself in this, have to accept some of the blame because we do not register early for events. The cashier windows here were open from 9 a.m. to 1 a.m. every day, and you could register for any circuit event during that time. Anytime, that's a 16-hour day you could have used to register. But people showed up here at 4:55 for a 5 o'clock event, and they were upset that they couldn't get in.
Well, yeah, I don't know how many people looked at the line and walked away. How many more people would have been in that tournament? How many people have stood in that line for an hour and finally said, "The heck with this," and left? I mean, there had to be tons.
Yep.
I talked to several people that were wandering around there and said, "There's not a chance in the world. I'm leaving. I'm not waiting for that line."
Yep.
Because that line was continual from, God, I don't know when it started, 4 o'clock in the afternoon maybe, till 10 or the o'clock that night, that there was a line up there of 20, 30, 40, 50 people in line. It just never seemed to go down.
Well, at one point there were 250 people in the line.
Well,
And it just took a long time. The 5 o'clock event was pushed back to 6 o'clock. I didn't get in it until 8 o'clock. And the 7 o'clock mega had to be pushed back to 9 o'clock, and those people had to be essentially in that same line. So, you know, it was a nightmare for a few hours there, but I think the only real hitch in the 12 days of this circuit event.
I absolutely agree with you. And think of all the other if you didn't start that mega till 11 o'clock at night, think what time it ended. And then if you wanted to play at 11 o'clock the next morning, it just had so many problems with it. I will give you 100% you're right that poker players need to look at this. They need to register early. Some of the blame can be there, no doubt about that. But if you were working all day, if you had no chance to do it, if you wanted to come there and play this tournament,
yep.
Missouri Gaming has some of the strictest laws in the country. You go to Nevada, you go to New Jersey, you go to tons of other states, you won't have this problem. Why is Missouri so much different and so much more difficult to play in than all these other states? I still don't understand that. What is different about Missouri than, you know, all these other states?
I think the difference is that our gaming commission doesn't play poker, doesn't hang around poker. All they really cared about when that line was so long was, well, make sure the line's not blocking the entrance as opposed to what can we do to make this better for the players and for the casino as well. You know, their attitude is, we don't care about that. We're only about compliance. And if this is a problem for you, well, then don't run this event. That's their attitude, and that's a horrible, horrible attitude. That's essentially telling your customers, the people who, as taxpayers, are paying your salary, even the people from out of state, are paying taxes on their poker winnings, and every time they walk in here, there's an admission fee that Harrah's pays to the state. So that's what's paying their salaries, and that can't be their attitude towards us. That's horrible.
I 100% agree, and I think you've nailed it right there. These are not poker players. These are people that all they seem to worry about is there some itty-bitty way that this could be possibly construed or wrong, therefore we're going to eliminate it. We aren't going to take a chance on anything. We don't care whether it's ridiculous. We don't care that 49 other states wouldn't do this. By gosh, we're going to do it. And it's just so ludicrous. They are the laughingstock of some of the people that come here.
Yep.
They literally are. They say, your compliance is doing what? You know, they just can't believe it. Their jaw drops to the ground when they hear some of these rules.
You do need to have rules and regulations, but they need to make
sense,
and they need to make things work in the best possible way for everyone concerned, and that's the opposite of what the Missouri Gaming Commission does.
And what would the state of Missouri do right now without the revenue from these casinos?
Right.
What state would they be in?
Yep. Absolutely right. All right, so we thank everybody who came to town, those of you who had to put up with that, those of you who enjoyed the great tournament action and the great cash action, 33 events in 12 days, a third year of the circuit event here at Harrah's St. Louis. Everyone here is looking at it as a success, and we hope it was successful for you as well. As I told you, we've got an absolutely packed show today. We're going to move right on to our first guest. He is the director of All In, the Poker Movie, which Dennis and I hosted the St. Louis premiere of last Thursday night. Here's a sample.
You know, the hero of the story was also cheating. And that's just not... the heroes of poker don't cheat.
Howard Lederer, who is featured in All In, the Poker Movie, and at that moment, if you're watching the movie and you know anything about the story of Black Friday and Full Tilt Poker and all the rest, you may have gulped or laughed, or Dennis and I, sitting a couple of seats away from each other, looked over at each other and went, ugh, almost simultaneously. Doug Tirola is the director of that movie, who worked for 3 years on putting it together, and we're glad he can join us now. Hi, Doug, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I was listening to the end of your comments about the gaming in Missouri, and I'm all fired up.
Well, you know, if you had extra time, you could do a whole documentary on how things are done here. But we know that you've had to change so much of what happened. You actually had the story done about 13 months ago, right before Black Friday hit. How much did you have to then go back and remake your movie?
I mean, we did some real soul searching. Let's put it that way. Our film was done. We had already had our first press screening. It was right around the time of the Final Four last year, I remember. And then 2 weeks later, we were hit with Black Friday, just like everyone in the poker community. And at that moment, we sort of had to say, is this just going to make people more interested in our movie, or do we need to stop, see what's going to happen with poker, with the characters in our movie, with the poker community, with the battle between the government, the poker world, and really take a year to let this thing play itself out a little bit? And that's what we decided to do.
Well, I wasn't privileged enough to see the first draft of the movie, but I did see the second one here, and I think you made a wise choice. The situation is so much different now than it was a year ago. So thank you for taking a deep breath and taking a step back and kind of readjusting the movie a little bit. I think you did well.
Well, thanks. I mean, my approach was that we were looking at poker almost as if it was a human being, and we were telling its life story with a focus on this last 10 years, the renaissance or the rebirth or the poker boom. And I didn't see how we could put a movie out there that didn't deal with what arguably could be one of the most important chapters in poker's story. And the thing that was tough for us is when you work so long on anything, a movie, a book, trying to start a business, you just want to sort of give birth to it. You want a reaction. And we knew the decision meant we weren't going to just fly to Vegas, interview seven people, and say that Black Friday happened. We need to see how people were going to react. And if you remember, the reaction to people a few weeks out compared to the when you get to the World Series, compared to the fall with what happened with Full Tilt, you know, all the way to the end of the year, you know, there's a lot of different ups and downs in that post-Black Friday story. Ultimately, our last interview was with Phil Hellmuth the week before Christmas in his hometown of Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, a quick thing I wondered about. I assumed because you did re-edit it, you did redo it after Black Friday, my first thought was, well, you had to pull out Howard Leiter in his quotes. You had to pull Chris Ferguson out in his quotes. You chose to leave those in there. Weren't you worried a little bit about criticism from that and some of the statements that they were making?
Well, no, because my feeling was that I believe that we have, you know, probably the last significant interview with either of them before Black Friday. Of course, everybody on their level in poker is used to doing, if not daily interviews, but close to that, almost the way a beat sports reporter covers, you know, whether it's the Cardinals or the Yankees or, you know, pick your team. And so you have a lot of little interviews with them, what happened on the river last night at that tournament. Well, you know, we have a 90-minute interview with each of them that goes into subjects that clearly they had not been asked about or had not been asked about very often. I think that's why each interview was like, hey, we got 20 minutes for you, kid. And then they went long because I think they were excited to talk about poker and where poker fit into in society. And, you know, ultimately, I think sort of what they say is maybe a little foreshadowing. You know, if you have a business that is having a problem, you know, you don't run out and tell all the employees and your customers, you know, hey, we might go down in a month. But these guys clearly, or at least I believe, probably had some idea what was going on. You don't go out of business or show up 140 million short on the ledger sheet in one night.
We're talking with Doug Tirola, the director of All In, the poker movie. In the movie, one of the people you include is Brian Koppelman, who with David Levine wrote the classic poker movie Rounders, which many people used as an inspiration to begin their ideas of becoming poker pros, and then the moneymaker effect you explore in the movie extensively as well. But just to stay on the Lederer and Ferguson theme, I think about about the movie Rounders, and there are parts of it that are supposedly based on Howard Lederer's life at the Mayfair with Eric Seidel and Dan Harrington and some of the others who were regulars there. If he was Matt Damon originally, after Black Friday, he's kind of become Edward Norton, hasn't he?
That's what I've been saying since the film came out. He went from being Matt Damon to the Worm to Ed Norton. And I think, you know, part of that, I think about the scene in Rounders with the state police where they're caught cheating. And one of the things about Ed Norton's character is that he almost doesn't know he did anything wrong. His reaction is like, you know, well, that's just part of it. You know, that he's almost sort of oblivious to the moral choice he made there in the movie, the Ed Norton character. And maybe that's part of it. I mean, I still hope that it's not as bad as everybody says. Certainly it's bad if you haven't gotten your money back, and that fact doesn't change. But, you know, I want to believe somewhere that it's bad judgment and mismanagement, not a, you know, planned-out scheme to steal money.
Well, I don't for one second believe it was that. There's no way this was any kind of a Ponzi scheme or anything like that. Bad management, bad judgment, bad decisions, lack of involvement, lack of following the money. I mean, you can throw a lot of things out there that I could believe. But I can't believe that they consciously went in this to steal people's money. I just refuse to believe that. So I
you know that, got that, it. You know, that's what I hope. The movie doesn't try and make a judgment on that one way or the other. Right? You know, that's why we don't have a scene of 10 people just yelling at the camera about these guys. Even though certainly... at a couple of the screenings in New York, you were describing reactions in St. Louis. Certainly there were some Saturday matinee boos and hisses at some of the screenings when they come up on screen. I felt that we had to keep them in there. A lot of what they talk about, I love when Chris Ferguson explains sort of how online poker came to be, and he's very gracious about the sites that came before his and somewhat complimentary about them, and that they're part of the story. Obviously, he felt his site was the best. But I think there's insights into their characters by seeing them answer the questions that we have. If you're a poker player and you're good at reading people, then, you can read into what you think they're saying when they're saying things and what you think they're saying when they're not saying things. But, ultimately, I felt we needed to have them in there.
The movie All In, the poker movie, is not just about post-Black Friday. There's a lot of stuff from before that. It includes interviews with lots of people. Doug mentioned Phil Hellmuth, Daniel Negreanu's in there. So is Matt Damon. I put together a little 90-second montage of some things from the movie, including them talking about what it was like to be a poker pro back in the days and to watch the World Series of Poker on TV back in the days. Roll it, Jason.
It just wasn't in the conscious a professional poker player, you know? I remember when I met my wife, and I asked her out on a date, and she said yes, and then, as she found out I was a professional poker player, she was going to try to cancel the date. She's like, oh, great.
If you told someone, I'm a professional poker player back in the late 90s, they'd kind of, maybe feel sorry for you and think you're broke all the time or something like that.
Dave needs a queen to win this pot.
In the old days, they didn't do it right. They showed this kind of tournament where you don't know what's happening. You don't see anybody's cards.
It seems to really be on the borderline.
Go back
to
the 70s and the early 80s when Stewie Unger won two World Series of Poker in a row, 80 and 81, I think it was.
Well, he's thinking to himself, maybe he might wait.
But you never knew why Stu folded. You wanted to know. Stu was an animal. He played very aggressively. He was raising and re-raising and raising, and you want to know what the hell, when Stewie folded, you want to know why did he fold?
I mean, I remember seeing Chris Ferguson. He was like, I was making breakfast one morning, and I saw him testifying in front of Congress, and he had taken $1 on an internet site, and he turned it into $20,000 without ever having more than 10% of his stack at risk. It's not, I think, which is why it's legal in California. It was proven to be a game of skill.
That is Matt Damon, as quoted in the documentary All In, the poker movie. Doris Kearns Goodwin is in there. Kenny Rogers, the gambler. Ira Glass. Frank DeFord, who calls poker a fad, by the way. How is it possible to stifle a laugh when he said that, Doug?
I mean, every film needs a villain, right? No. I think Frank DeFord was great. I mean, he really brings the gravitas. He's a world-class sports writer who's been around for decades. That's his view of it. And I understand that. And, I wouldn't say we were laughing, but obviously we disagree with that. But I think what Frank brings to the film is a sense of how poker was viewed by society. And he does have background in sports, and I think he puts poker into context in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And I think he also talks about just how society has changed. And I think there are some similarities to some extent about how people viewed poker as a social activity. And now maybe some people view poker as a way to try and make a living or a quick score. And I think there is something to that.
You also have Nolan Dalla, the media director for the World Series of Poker, who was on our show last week. He's in there as a poker historian. It really does go through a lot of material, 2 hours full of information about the game, and even non-poker players, I think, will learn a lot about our game. It's called All In, the Poker Movie. It's available for download on iTunes today, right, Doug?
It's available on iTunes today, and the DVD will come out over the summer. We've been using a lot of the screenings to talk to audiences and find out what they'd like those extras to be like that come on DVDs. And that will come out around the time of the World Series. And you can go to our website to pre-order that as well. But
put the entire letter, Put the entire Lederer and Ferguson interviews on there. That, I want to see those, don't you, Dennis?
Let me tell you, I could probably go through the cutting room floor on that thing and spend a few weeks is what I could probably do.
Doug, yeah. We appreciate your time. Congratulations on the work and all the hard work that you put into it. Thanks so much.
I appreciate for being on, and like I said, I'm fired up about the Missouri Gaming Commission after I heard the intro.
Well, thank you. We're going to be talking about them a lot more in the future. Doug Tirola, director of All In the Poker Movie, here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris here in St. Louis. Now, while we've mentioned Ferguson and Lederer and their company, Full Tilt Poker, there is news today, Dennis, about Full Tilt Poker, which people had been hoping was going to be bought by this French group that was going to pour money into them, and that might mean that players were going to get their money back. But we heard today from Group Bernard Tapie that sale is a fail. You have more details on this than I do, so you fill our listeners in.
Well, it came out that the sale will not go through, that they're going to pull out of it. They're going to pursue other avenues. After 6 months of teasing us and trying putting something together, they have declared today and made a statement, not from the DOJ, but from the Tappy Group, that they are no longer pursuing purchasing of the Full Tilt. They did leave a little bit of an opener in their statement, well, if something changes or whatever. But they did come up with something else interesting in the statements, and it's been reacted in several other different places. They are claiming that there's an offer on the table from PokerStars to buy Full Tilt, which, Daniel said, I don't know what the heck's going on. I would be very surprised for it. I myself was very surprised. Sean Deeb posted on here, and this is verbatim what he said. PokerStars has reached an agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice to buy Full Tilt Poker. The things I heard, one, all players will be refunded 100%. Two, both sites will be back online. Three, both sites have promotions. Four, employees remain in place in both places. And expect more news today. Now, that's what's posted out there.
Now, we do have to say, none of this is confirmed. And as I've said for 7 months now, until the Department of Justice issues a statement, I don't believe anything is fact. But these are the stories that are running around the Internet today. The only thing we know for sure, because we have an official statement from the Bernard Tapie Group, is that their deal with Full Tilt Poker is off.
Yep, absolutely off. Everybody is scrambling, trying to get confirmation, trying to find out if those rumors are true. Any kind of a word from it. Andrew Feldman, a writer for ESPN, has reached out to PokerStars and asked for any kind of an official comment or anything like that. Star's comment was no comment, which if you go on to the different chat sites and everybody is reading as a positive thing. I'm not for sure why, but they're saying, well, if it was an out-and-out rumor that there wasn't any truth to it or whatever, they would just deny it and move on. Since they're not denying it, it must be true. I'm afraid I can't go there, guys.
you know, my brother has been working in government and politics for a long, long time, and he taught me a famous quote of his, which is, I can neither confirm nor deny what you're asking me, and you should not take my lack of confirmation or denial as a confirmation or a denial.
And he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Now then, I mean, I can speculate on this. I could come up with all sorts of wide-ranging things, but I have absolutely nothing but what you see on the different web pages and the different posts and everything that are coming out there.
All right, well then speculate for me. How would it work if PokerStars did buy Full Tilt Poker? Would they just absorb the software and use it to change their software? Would they put Full Tilt Poker back up and run parallel sites? And the most important question in all this is, would the players get their money back?
Okay. My speculation. First of all, let's go on the advantages if PokerStars would buy this site. They would get what is arguably the second best software in the business. Chris Ferguson might say it's the best. I would argue with that, but it's definitely a very good site. Software-wise, one of the top in the world, if not one of the top two. They get it. That means a competitor doesn't get it. They get the database. They get tremendous amounts of positive feedback on this. And I will sue this because I have had personal talks with Esai in the past. I absolutely 100% guarantee that he thinks about the players first. And I would absolutely 100% guarantee if there's any agreement with Stars buying full tilt, it will entail players getting their money back, period.
Okay.
I just cannot figure any way in the world that they would want to step into this in which there isn't a guarantee that all players would get their money back.
So how would it work? One story out today says the Poker Stars would buy Full Tilt for $750 million. There's now $330 million that is owed to the players. Would that $330 be included in that $750? And if so, where does the other $420 million go? It certainly is not going to Ray First, Howard Lederer, Ray Bittar, and Chris Ferguson.
Oh, no, not at all. Now stop and think for a minute. In the original indictment, they were collecting or trying to collect $3 billion, $1.5 billion from PokerStars, $1 billion from Full Tilt, and $500 million from the Ultimate Bet Absolute Poker Group. They've seized a ton of different accounts. Nobody has an exact accounting of how much. They've seized a lot of personal accounts from Howard Lederer and Ray Bittar and Chris Ferguson. They've seized houses from Ray Bittar, I know for sure, and I think some other people. I mean, they've got a whole colossal group, a sizable amount of money and assets that they have sitting there right now. All right, let's just go crazy for a minute. PokerStars walks in. We're going to write you a check for $750 million. You're going to take $330 of that and pay every single player that's owed on Full Tilt so that the players get 100% of their money back. All right?
Mm-hmm.
The other $400 we're going to count as buying their assets, their software, their database, their name, their whatever the heck you want to split it up and however you want to do it. Now look at what happens with the DOJ there in New York. They have now effectively shut down Full Tilt. They've got the positive publicity they've got for putting down a site that was being mismanaged, that was being run in a bad place. They've put together a deal where every single U.S. player is going to get their money back, and they have literally hundreds of millions in assets and cash that they've collected still sitting in their coffers. I'm trying to see a downside for the DOJ on this.
Well, does that then count as a settlement with PokerStars that might pave the way for them to get back into the United States, Dennis?
Well, again, my speculation, I have nothing to base this on,
right.
My speculation is that PokerStars has never admitted doing anything wrong. To my knowledge, they haven't done anything wrong. To my knowledge, they have no problem walking into a courtroom and facing the accusations and saying, you prove I did something wrong. So, again, I don't know. Maybe both sides don't want to end up in court. Maybe the DOJ doesn't want to take the chance of losing the court case, which would be a black mark against them. This is a way they can step out of it. You know, they can look on it. They can call part of it a fine. They can call part of it a settlement. And both sides, neither side agrees to, you know, that they've done anything wrong, admit any guilt at all. But, you know, it's a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's other negative connotations that go with this thing, too, though. If they absorb Full Tilt, and even if they open it as a separate site or as one site or whatever the heck they happen to do with it, antitrust laws are going to come into play now.
Hmm.
They would be huge or outside of the U.S. I can't even fathom the percentage of penetration they would then have. It would be phenomenal. And if they come back into the U.S., what poker player would not want to play on PokerStars now? They've given and done everything right when their site was closed. They immediately withdrew from the U.S. They gave every penny back to every player. They complied with everything the DOJ did. And then when Full Tilt's out here and all these people have all the money sitting there, they're almost like a knight on a white horse riding up there and saying, here it is. We'll make sure the players get taken care of.
Now, again, this is all speculation, and even in even in the Bernard Tappy group, they say, we understand from press reports that the DOJ may have entered into an agreement with PokerStars. pursuant to which PokerStars will acquire the FTP assets. They're not saying that they know this is a fact. They're saying, we've heard stories that say this, and so have we. And I'll go back to what I said before, and which I've been saying for months and months and months. Until Preet Bharara and the Southern District of New York Office of the United States Attorney of the Department of Justice come forward and say, here's what the deal is going to be, there ain't no deal. And we're going to leave it at that.
That sounds good to me.
Let's take a quick break. Then we'll talk to Faraz Jocko, who's in Europe for a couple of big events there and has been for quite a while. I'm Paul Harris. He's Dennis Phillips. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com with our podcast via iTunes and Stitcher Radio and thechipleader.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, coming to you live from the World Series of Poker Room of Harrah's St. Louis and from Las Vegas. A reminder that in May you can enter the satellites for the big one. For one drop, $100 buy-in could get you into the $1 million buy-in event this summer at the World Series of Poker. And also this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the 28th and 29th, they will be doing the double shootout format once again. For $200, you beat 18 people, and you end up with a seat in the $10,000 main event at the World Series of Poker. That's how Dennis got there in 2008, and that's how I've won my seat into the 2012 main event. You'll have shots this Saturday and Sunday at Harrah's St. Louis. For details on all this, go to harrahsstlewis.com. Our next guest today is Faraz Jocko. Last time we talked to him was a little over a year ago at Caesar's Palace at the NBC National Heads Up Championship. Since then, he's been a very busy guy. Just a couple weeks ago, played in the inaugural event of iSeries Live, and now is in Berlin, about to get on a plane to head to Monte Carlo to play in the EPT Grand Final. Hi, Faraz. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, guys? Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you on. When I originally emailed you that we wanted to have you on, it was going to be about iSeries Live, this event where you and nine other pros were going to compete in a winner-take-all huge event that was going to be live online. That event has now taken place. How was it for you?
That awesome. That event was amazing. For me, poker-wise, it didn't fare so well, but we all had a blast playing the event. I talked to all my friends, and a lot of fans tweeted at me. They sounded like they had a blast watching it, so I really hope that it does well and that, you know, we have more events like that in the future. I'm sure anyone who watched it can see we're all laughing, joking around the entire time. It was way more fun than a typical tournament.
I had heard that they're looking to possibly expand it to 30 or 40 players next time. Is that going to help or hinder it, do you think?
I could see it hindering it. It kind of depends who those players are, because I think we had a really good group of entertaining players. So if they can pick those 30 or 40 players that are going to be good for television, then definitely would help it. I don't know who they have in mind exactly, so it kind of depends on that.
The players who were at the table included David Devilfish Iliad and Daniel Negreanu and Phil Hellmuth and Carlos Mortensen and Maria Ho and Owen O'Dea and the eventual winner, James Dempsey. And people could bet on these. You went off before the event as 8-1, which kind of put you in the middle of the pack there. But early on, you got involved in a hand. I think this was even in the first round for Roz, where it was a huge five-way hand, which you had just called with pocket threes. You flopped a set, and Carlos Mortensen had slow-played queens.
Yeah.
And you took an enormous, I think you took 85% of his chips. I mean,
he
started with 100K, and I think you took 85K off of him. Your numbers then dropped, and you became the favorite because you were such a huge chip leader.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that hand and what was going through your mind as you played it.
Well, on the flop, I just called the original bets, which I think most people would expect me to have raised a set there. I haven't really played with Carlos at all, but I know he's aware of my reputation, so I just felt like if, you know, I could take him to Value Town hardcore here, and he's not going to believe me, And I'm playing my hand so strong in a spot where, again, I normally, most players would have raised a set on the flop. So I there was a lot of draws there that I'd missed as well. So, I mean, I just thought it was a pretty unlucky spot for him if he has a big hand. I put him on something more like some sort of two-pair, just top-pair hand, not queens.
Were you surprised that he called you down all the way with just one pair?
I wasn't surprised. I mean, again, I'm aware of my reputation, and it seemed like he thought something fishy was up. And like I said, I played the hand a bit slow where I don't think he would expect me to. So, no, I mean, I definitely thought there's a good chance that I'm going to look kind of fishy over here.
Let me ask you about one other hand. I know Dennis has questions, but there's one other hand I want to ask you about here. On the very first hand, the blinds are 500 and 1,000. Again, everybody has a 100,000 stack.
Yeah.
Phil Hellmuth opens with ace-king of hearts for 3,000, comes back around to Maria Ho, who is in, I think, one of the blinds, and she makes it 8,800 with ace-king offsuit. Phil then makes it 22,000, and Maria folds. Now, of course, at the time, you have no idea what's going on, and you're sequestered, so you don't know what's going on. A, what's going through your mind at the time? It's the very first hand, and B.
I mean, I'll tell you the first thing that was going on in my mind is Phil Hellmuth raised. I really want to 3-bet him this hand. That was the first thing I thought of. I mean, once he 4-bet, I mean, I can't see Phil Hellmuth messing around in that spot. I know he would not want to bust early with a weak hand. You know, just how much pride he takes in not making mistakes, not getting it in bad. And, you know, even just for his fans, you know, he probably wanted a lot of people to bet on him and for him to get it in, even with ace-king. So I'm actually really surprised he had ace-king and didn't flat. So that is surprising to me. I mean, what was he going to do if Maria jammed there? I mean, I was pretty surprised to find out he had ace-king. And Maria's spot, I almost wouldn't mind the flat because... I mean, I don't know. I just don't know how much value are you going to get out of Phil Hellmuth out of that in the first hand. And, you know, flatting, you might play your hand a little more deceivingly, whereas once you 4-bets, you've just turned your hand into a bluff. I guess a little surprising on a few different fronts there.
Wow, I got so many questions. I before we move on, you said, knowing my reputation, what do you think people portrayed your reputation as when you sit at a table, and how do you exploit that?
I mean, it goes, you know, different between different players. I mean, there's the type of players where, you know, they think I know that they know what my reputation is, so, you know, I'm not going to get too out of line. And there's the other type of players that might, you know, take it the other way and think I'm just going to keep pedal to the metal. You know, with someone like Carlos, again, I had not played with him before. So, I mean, and we've never really talked. I mean, there's no reason for him to really, you know, take it to that next level and be like, oh, Faraz probably knows. I know this about him. You know, because he's not, you know, your typical player that's, you know, in touch with the online world and on forums and, you know, has, you know, friends with a lot of the younger guys. So, you know, I figured he might not really take it to that next level and expect me to be thinking along those lines. But, you know, it really goes both ways. I mean, there's no one answer. You know, it goes either way. It's a game of leveling at the end of the day.
Yeah, I sometimes when we sit down there and people joke about it, it doesn't make any difference what two cards you have in front of you. It's how you play the game. Mm-hmm. It really is in a lot of hands.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's awesome in position and everything like that. Carlos just had to be sick after that hand.
Yeah, and it's also early in the tournament. So it kind of looks like I'm putting him in a really tough spot, and most people don't want to bust out, you know, when we just started. And he knows I'm the type of guy to really put pressure on you. So it's a great spot for me to put pressure on him. And, you know, he's not someone who's really scared to throw down and call, but he might not think that I think of him like that since we've never played together.
Wow. How many levels of meta thinking are going on here, Dennis? This is unbelievable. You're going to think about how is Hellmuth going to play it? What would he do? What if I jammed? What if he doesn't? Same thing with Carlos. Does he know my reputation? Does he not know my reputation? Does he want to go out early? There's money on us. We get a piece of the money. All of this is going through your mind.
I just end up leveling myself half the time.
How was it being sequestered for this and having no contact with the outside world. I don't know if you're a guy who checks Twitter during tournaments or uses an iPad at the table. How was it to not have access to the rest of the world the entire time you were playing?
It didn't really matter to me. I mean, I definitely, you know, I tweet updates when I'm playing, and that's just more for my friends and fans to follow. But yeah, I mean, I didn't mind. I thought it was kind of cool to just kind of just be us and no other distractions, and, you know, again, to add with like the psychology aspect of the game. So, I mean, it didn't bother me either way.
Also, they have so many different kind of, I'm going to call them prop bets, for lack of a better word, the same thing they did at the Super Bowl and such like that. Did you partake any? Did you think any of them were kind of way out in left field? Like, they had, what shirt is Tom Brady's son going to be wearing when he shows up at the Super Bowl type things?
Yeah.
Or something you might add to it different? What did you think of the prop bets that they had there?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think they can add a lot more fun stuff. I mean, okay, there's two different parts of that because, for example, you could bet on red and black, which obviously is good for the company, but since we're doing, you know, a profit share, you know, that's less people betting on me personally. So, you know, there's the issue of what's better for the company and what's better for me personally. You know, I'd rather there more bets that were based on, you know, again, people that could bet Faraz bet in the next hand, Faraz win the tournament. Even if it's Faraz busting next hand, you know, I don't care. Bet on me is better for me, right? but, of course, you know, there's, you know, what's best for me might not be best for the organization.
By the way, when Faraz talks about getting a percentage, what happened was any amount of money that was bet on or against you, if you were involved in a bet and people online, not in the U.S. and Canada, of course, but in Europe or elsewhere, were to bet on this through the Paddy Power site, you guys ended up getting a percentage of that money. Is that how it worked?
Yes.
Okay, so how much is that going through your mind when you're playing, which is, if I go in on a draw here and get knocked out, I could lose prop money later on, as opposed to if I just sit here and play ultra tight and hang around for as long as possible. You know, it's like moving up the money ladder in a tournament. Seventh doesn't pay as much as sixth. Sixth, I might get more prop bets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in one thing in general, I would assume that the longer you're in the tournament, the more chances there are for people to bet on you. So I definitely have an interest in being in the tournament longer. Also, you know, by winning now, you know, every time someone gets knocked out, there's less people to bet on. So there's also that incentive. But at the end of the day, you still need to win the tournament. So to some extent, your incentives are aligned with winning, which is very good. As far as even playing really tight so you could last around longer, there's not, I mean, it's brand new. So there's not enough money we're getting from the profit share for it to really alter our decisions, you know, from giving up, you know, when we're winning $100,000 for winning the event. So I don't think that really altered things too much. I thought of it more as the more entertaining you are, the more likely people are going to bet on you, you know.
Yeah.
People who don't know who any of us are, maybe besides Helmuth and Negreanu, you know, if they see me with a flashy red coat and they see someone else next to me who doesn't really stand out, they might be more likely to bet on the guy with the flashy red coat. So I could think of it more in those terms. Maybe my answer would change if this thing blew up and all of a sudden, you know, we're making a ton off the profit share, but not yet.
So we can see, like, somebody from, like, Gavin Griffin painting his hair pink or something at the next table.
Yeah.
Or who knows what.
Do you know, have you talked to Brian about how many people actually watch this thing? Because I watched a little bit for like the first 90 minutes or so, which is how I knew about those hands.
I haven't kept up with too much details. I know during the event they had said there was maybe 3,000-4,000 people at one time watching the live stream.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. I mean, that's not total, you know, that's just at one time and people are coming and going. So that was the only stat I really heard. I'm going to, you know, chat with them and try to really hear all the details once I'm done with this Euro trip, but I really just haven't had time.
I guess I should mention the results here, by the way. Faraz, even though he became chip leader very early on, ended up going out sixth, and Carlos Mortensen, who he had wounded so much early on, ended up working his way back to go out in fourth place. And the final three came down to James Dempsey, Devilfish Elliott, and Maria Ho, who made a nice laydown on that first hand against Phil and stuck around a long time, and probably is the only woman at the table, was getting people betting for or against her just based on gender. But in the end, it was James Dempsey heads up with Devilfish Elliott, and James Dempsey, who, by the way, had taken down the WPT event at the Five Diamond at Bellagio last year, now is the first iSeries Live champion. Any idea when there's going to be another one?
Next iSeries event?
Yeah.
I hear they're talking about one in Vegas during the series, but it's really just speculation. You know, there's a lot of things they got to figure out legally before they can get into that. So that's so possibly this summer, but, you know, we'll see.
Part of the thing that when they did this, because we talked to Daniel about it, he's the one that set up the structure to try and get it done in like 6, 7, 8 hours from beginning to end. If you expand it to 30 or 40 players, are they going to then have to pay the top 3 or 4? Are they going to have to make it a 2-day event? Are they going to have to get real aggressive in a schedule? How are they going to try? How are they going to be able to do that?
Yeah, you know, I really haven't heard what they're planning on for, you know, if making it a bigger event. I mean, I really enjoyed it the way it was, to be honest. So I would not mind if it was, you know, another single table like this. But, yeah, I mean, if they see there's more chances to bring in revenue by having it larger, then, you know, by all means, of course, that makes sense from a business standpoint.
All right, let's talk about something else here. We mentioned that you're in Berlin now and you're going to go to Monte Carlo tomorrow. Right. Have you been in Europe ever since this event 3 weeks ago
since
in Dublin?
Before it. So someone asked me how long I've been on the road for, and I said, well, I flew for EPT Madrid on March 10th, but I realized I guess I wasn't really home before that either. I've been homeless for about 9 months now.
Wow.
So it was just traveling in the U.S., and now I'm traveling in Europe. So yeah, I got here for EPT Madrid on March 10th, and then I went to EPT Campione, which is on the border of Italy and Switzerland. Went to Dublin, went to WPT Vienna, Berlin, and now I'm going to Monte Carlo. And in between, I had some recreation time, so I went to Paris, Czech Republic, and also Gdansk in Poland.
Answering the question, wow, what's it like to be a professional poker player?
It's awesome. There's a lot of freedom. You get to work your own hours, but at times it is very challenging because when you don't have a boss telling you what to do, you really have to be dedicated and force yourself. So
and
a lot
also,
of pain and pleasure.
And also expensive.
Yeah, very expensive. You know, my first time traveling tournaments in Europe 3 years ago, you know, I did a lot of the things the regulars are doing as far as ordering room service, staying in expensive hotels, just spending a lot of money on stupid stuff, even dry cleaning and the staff in the hotel. I just have a completely different mindset. I kept track of every dollar I spent for 3 years and recorded it on an Excel sheet and was just amazed at how much money I can save, you know, if I stay at, you know, the hotel down the street instead or, you know, avoid room service and go grocery shopping. And it's almost like a game to me now. I go to these events and see how little money I could spend. And, you know, it's kind of more fun like that, too, because you feel like a normal person, you know, when you're just having things done for you in this luxurious way the entire year, you know, you start to lose touch with reality and forget what normal people deal with.
I think there's some young people that need to listen to the words you just said there, some words of wisdom. Well said, that's for sure. And there's nothing worse, because I've done this, than waking up and you don't wonder exactly, you know, am I in a hotel room or what? You wonder what country you're in for a second.
That's happened. That's definitely happened to me.
You know, when I was listening to you talking like that, I thought to myself, this guy's a businessman. And then I remembered, you are a businessman. How's the board business?
It's going well. We have some exciting things on the horizon that I cannot speak of right now, but hopefully we'll be able to soon. So for those of you who don't know, my first startup is AxisCasterBoarding.com. It's a board that combines the elements of a skateboard, snowboard, and surfboard. And they've been around for about 6 years as a toy, but we're trying to turn it into a sport now. And I actually haven't been putting much time into that recently. My partners are running that. I've moved on to something new. We're making a sports health drink, so it's something I'm very excited about. And we hopefully will have it to market in about 3-4 months. So I'm going to be tweeting and talking about that quite a bit soon.
Well, when you do, let us know.
Yeah, Alrighty. Definitely.
And we'll go from there. Anything else exciting in your life? Anything new? Anything else you want to talk about?
Well, this coming up, we have Monte Carlo, which so many events. I've been on this trip for, like I said, 2 months in Europe and haven't cashed a single main event. I just realized that I've played more EPTs than WPTs in the last 4 years and literally have not cashed a main event. So looking forward to really getting down in grind mode for this next, this last couple weeks of this Euro grind.
Well, good luck with the grind, and also good luck living on the cheap in Monte Carlo. I think it's impossible, but it's great to have you back on the show for Oz. We look forward to seeing you again, probably this summer out at the Rio.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Firas Jaka joining us live from Berlin on his way to Monte Carlo to play in the EPT Grand Final tomorrow. Always a terrific guest. We appreciate his time, as we do Doug Tirola. And nothing has broken on the Full Tilt story in the last 16 minutes. I just want to let our audience know nothing new has happened since we told you about some rumors, and we'll keep you posted on it on next week's show. Dennis, are you going to be playing any poker this week or taking it easy after our busy schedule for the last week and a half?
In a couple of days, I'm actually heading back down to Durant, Oklahoma, the Choctaw Casino down there. Chad Brown is hosting a tournament down there that's been going on for the last week. I'm going down there to play in the main event with him. Chad's a great guy. Got an invitation, and we're heading down there.
Nice. Well, I'm about to sit down to another game of PLO, which we always start up here at Harrah's St. Louis right after the final table show is over. So I'll do that, and we'll meet you back here next Tuesday at 3. Remember, you can download our podcast via iTunes and Stitcher Radio, and you can also get information about all the events coming up here, including the main event qualifiers this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, by going to harrahsstlewis.com. For Dennis Phillips, I'm Paul Harris. This is 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.